Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is August 6, 2004. Today's session number is SUK 2004-05. Today's speaker is Carla Samala, and the lesson for today is Here I Am, Lord, Responding to Call in Jewish Literature and Tradition. Isaiah, Called for Others. Let's listen in.
It's been, I figured, a little less than 12 hours since we did this class. All right. So we're kind of all in the mode. We went to bed with this on our minds, and here we are first thing again this morning. For those of you who are new today, I'm Carla Samala from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and I teach Hebrew Bible and Judaism there. And we're just concluding a week here on call in the Hebrew Bible and how it's examined in the Jewish tradition, specifically in the phrase Hineni in Hebrew or Here I Am in English. And I've been having some readings for you every day, and I've got a few more this morning that are kind of interesting. We talked about this balance between study and action, reflection and doing self in the world. And we've also talked about the different kinds of students. Were you the sponge that takes everything in, or the filter which keeps the dregs and lets the good stuff go? There are four different possibilities. Well, here's another perspective on learning. There's a story about a learned man who came to see the Kotzker. He was a Hasidic rabbi. No longer young, he was close to 30. The visitor had never before been to a rebbe. You can tell these things are dated. I looked at that. Wait a second. No longer young, he was close to 30? What have you done all your life? The master asked him. I have gone through the whole Talmud 3 times, answered the guest. Yes, but how much of the Talmud has gone through you? Rabbi Mendel inquired. So that sense of reading and studying to be transformed, all right? And the rabbis had this sense, don't bother unless there's not some transformation that will take place. Reading through the Talmud, although an admirable task, as I pointed out, this is quite a collection of texts. If it didn't make any difference in his life, it didn't become part of his fabric, then there was really no point in doing it. Another word that's come up this week is fear, in terms of fearing God, and kind of reflect a little bit on that. Is that fear as in being afraid? Is it only negative, or does it have the sense of being in awe? And I think it can have both of those ideas, as well as others. But here's another idea on fear. A disciple of the Kotzker complained to his master that he was unable to worship God without becoming aware of his pride. Is there a way of praying that prevents the self from intruding? He asked. Have you ever met a wolf while walking alone in the forest? I have, he answered. What was on your mind at that moment? Fear. Nothing but fear and the need to escape. You see, said, replied the Kotzker, at that moment you are afraid without being self-conscious or aware of your fear. It is in this way that we must worship God. Kind of an interesting take on that. Fear as just being the natural reaction, the thing that emerges within us in that sort of moment. And the rabbi compares that sort of fear to worshiping God, something that's not self-conscious, that's part of our survival, that's just an important part of living. I thought that was kind of an interesting take on that. Well, today we're going to be looking at Isaiah, where the tables are turned a little bit. In the passages that we have here, the session 5 in your packet, we have the word or the phrase, here I am or Hineni, in God's mouth. And God is the one saying it this time. We've seen it on human lips throughout the week. What does it mean for God to say this? Right? So if you could take a look in your packet to those Isaiah passages. The first one, whether you have a packet or a Bible, the first one is Isaiah 65, verse 1. says, I was ready to be sought out by those who did not ask, says the Lord, to be found by those who did not seek me. I said, here I am, to a nation that did not call on my name. I held out my hands all day long to a rebellious people who walk in a way that is not good, following their own devices. Kind of an interesting passage. Here we have, what do you notice in just those few short verses, two verses actually, about this Hineni, or here I am? What jumps out at you?
The first thing that gets me is no one called God.
No one?
There is no God. They're not even aware.
Yeah, God is saying, here I am, to people who aren't even aware of what's going on. Yeah, there's been nothing previous to that. What else stands up?
God is ready.
Yeah, God is ready. God is ready, definitely. Other details.
Well, the double. Here
the I double. Am. This is the first time that we see in all of these passages, we've seen a double call of names. Abraham, Abraham. Moses, Moses, Samuel, Samuel, Jacob, Jacob. Here we've got, here I am, here I am. Kind of an interesting flip here in this passage where you have this double response instead of a double call. I thought that was kind of interesting. Why would God need to call double or respond doubly?
Well, it's just been the same in a different perspective back to Moses. Mm-hmm. God called Moses. But the burning bush that gets Moses' attention. Mm-hmm. It's not the call, it's something else that God had to do just to get Moses' attention. Mm-hmm. I tend to be that way. Somebody has to hit me upside the head to get my attention. So, you know, we don't hear that. We're too busy with our own thoughts and stuff. So, and I also work with sound systems. When you ever be a page, the standard way of paging somebody is first name, last name, wait. Do it again, and then give the message, because they didn't hear it the first time. So if you just say, Dave called 753, Dave didn't know you were talking to him. But if it's Dave called 753, that they'll hear.
So in this way, for God to be doing that, here I am. No, really, here I am.
Yeah.
You know, even though you weren't calling, I am here, ready. Kind of an interesting thing. And when we took a look at the different possibilities of here I am, and we continue to explore those, I'm ready, I'm willing, I'm prepared, I know who I am, I'm self-aware, it's got all those sorts of things to it. What do we make of that when God says, here I am? What does it mean for God to say, I'm ready, I'm willing, I'm prepared? I know who I am.
You need to know it.
It's kind of like it looks as if God is ready for a relationship there. You know, it's pretty clear when we see people needing God. Is it possible that God needs people in the same way?
I would say not in the same way, but he certainly has chosen and wants to respond in a close relationship to people. But it's not an essential need of his.
We can talk about that. Is our humans an essential need for God? Could God do without us? We can go on a little ego trip this morning. Can you hear it? Yep.
I think we were created for relationship. Mm-hmm. I think that was good. I don't know. I didn't presuppose God, but that's how I think.
So that God created us to be in relationship.
My question would be, why would he have created people if he didn't want and need them?
Is there a difference between want and need there? Did God need humanity?
If we consider that God's primary character is love, love in a singular setting has no purpose.
Can you think of it? If there's that sense of, also, if you take a look at another characteristic of God, at least according to the rabbis in the biblical text, it's very strongly justice. What point of justice is there in a singular setting? Yeah, interesting. Or peace? Why do you need love, peace, or justice with one being? And if those are what we call essential to the character of God, compassion, mercy, can't have those in a singular setting. So So we take a look at that question again. For God to be who God is, does God need people? Yeah?
The heavenly host, the seraphim, the cherubim, the heavenly multitudes work into that. I've always been curious about that.
You know, it's kind of interesting in terms of the different biblical authors, in terms of the emphasis that they place on this sort of heavenly retinue, and it's not clear what those beings are or what role they serve. But there is never a sense, except perhaps in Job, where God confers with God's counsel. And it's kind of interesting that the Satan is part of that counsel, but that there's a sort of a relationship or need in that. And it looks as if there's some ambivalence within the biblical text as to the role of these creatures. It's not clear what they are, where they are, how they exist, and if they fulfill that an area where God can exercise justice and mercy, compassion, and love. So I don't know. That's a question to keep open, but the biblical text does not address that as fully as we might like to have it do.
But can you have that love-justice relationship where everyone, by their nature, adores completely God? And that's, I mean, there doesn't seem to be a very dynamic relationship there.
You mean
single function? I liken it to the groupies of a rock star. You know, there's no dialogue between the groupies of a rock star or a football star per se. They're just hanging out.
Is that what God wants, though? Take a look at these responses. Does God want groupies? There's a sense of true worship, but does God create groupies in creation? And look at the characters that we've looked at already. How do they interact with God?
Arguing.
They argue. Yeah, it looks as if some of God's best companions are debaters. Mm-hmm. Abraham and Moses, top among them. The small debate in Exodus 3 that we looked at with Moses continues throughout the book of Exodus. If you take a look at Exodus 32, 33, 34, they have a long, ongoing, you know, fight, if you will, about what's going on with the people of Israel after the golden calf. These characters are debaters. Abraham did the same thing. Jacob goes further than that. What did Jacob do?
Wrestled.
These are not groupies. Sometimes we forget that.
Was that a result of original sin? Adam and Eve were originally created for obedience or not? They know they had free will, but the idea, I'm not trying to second guess God, but it was that they would obey and love and carry on with his creation, in my mind, without sinning.
Are you saying that like Abraham and Moses and these characters were sinning by engaging in debate?
Unknown.
It might be known. Does it look at the biblical text? Are there any commandments or injunctions against debate or dialogue or even wrestling or some sort of combat in just circumstances? It doesn't look to me, from anything I've read, that there's anything in opposition to that. And did God, and our assumption is that God created people to do God's will. That's perhaps our assumption. What is God's will? Is debate part of that?
I was thinking that might be construed as pride or trying to be like a Tower of Babel type of thing. Trying to elevate yourself toward God. And that too, if God, I don't know, if there's a continuum there, or if you can try a little bit. Again,
I think the reasons are there, and that's an important point. Take a look at the people who are arguing or debating with God. Are they doing it for their own sake or for the sake of the other? Is Abraham, does he have anything to gain by keeping Sodom and Gomorrah around? Personally, really nothing. He will not have personal gain by keeping them alive. Actually, they'd probably be kind of a hassle for him. But he still argues to keep the righteous alive. Take a look at Moses. After the golden calf, God is so angry, God says, I want to destroy these people, and Moses, we're going to start from scratch. I will make you. I will put you in charge of a whole new nation. We'll just start over. If I were Moses, I would have thought, he'd been wandering with these people in the wilderness. He knew what he was dealing with. Instead, he argues with God not to destroy the people of Israel. He identifies with the people of Israel, so he is not arguing for his own benefit there. Actually, in many ways, he's arguing against what might be the prideful thing to do. The prideful thing to do, at least in my mind, it would have been, yeah, I'll take that new nation thing. You know, definitely. So, you know, and I think there are times when people argue for their own sake. But what we see in these key characters is that they seem to be debating or engaging God for the sake of the other. And God seems to look at that and say, yep, that's what I created humanity for. You know, that, and I think that that's part of it. Kind of an interesting thing. You want to comment?
Well, God in human form, Jesus, goes, why am I stuck in the cross? And do I have to do this? It's a whole a debate between the Father and himself, the same thing.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Is it seem negative? No, it seems that it's
trying
human...
to change his mind. Oh, hey, wait a minute. This isn't too good.
Exactly. You know, we do have that sort of engagement. I mean, this is a really interesting part of the Jewish tradition, this whole emphasis on that sort of communication with God. Jewish tradition really does emphasize that sense that God needs humans, not just wants. And you can agree or disagree with this. It's not a closed debate. But the Jewish tradition seems to come out on the side that God needs us. Kind of an interesting sort of thing. And not only that, God wants to engage humans in this sort of debate. What is it about debate? What happens in debate that would be interesting or important to God?
Strengthening faith.
Strengthening faith on the part of the human?
Yep.
All right. And a debate with each other, let's say. You know, we're in political debates these days. We debate all kinds of things.
That's an expression of free will.
So you mean engaging in debate?
Yes.
All right.
Issues become clarified?
You're taking the other person seriously when you debate with them.
You're taking the other person seriously. I guess there are a couple ways to engage another person. Yes.
I think it would be a sign of love, even. If you don't debate or argue with the person you're in love with, you don't have a relationship. I mean, you need to talk things through and debate.
You know, you always have these cartoons about marriages with the guy at the coffee table. Yes, dear. Yes, dear. Yes, dear. Is that a relationship? No, that there's not any sort of engagement there. Somehow that idea of debate engagement is taking the other and their views seriously.
Well, if you remember reading that book, Life and Death in Shanghai, where the author is in solitary confinement, and she said every day she'd try to pick a fight with the guard because it made her feel better. So she would think and think and think, what can I engage him in today that he'll talk to me and debate with me?
What was it that made her feel better in your view?
Well, I think it raises your, physically it raises your adrenaline levels and it makes you feel human.
It made her feel human. If you're in solitary confinement, you might lose your sense of humanity. How do you keep a sense of humanity? Pick a fight.
Yes. That is exactly the point of solitary confinement. The whole purpose of solitary confinement is to break down your will, to dehumanize you to the point that you will become passive. Whatever you want, I'll do it.
So God before humanity, solitary confinement?
I'm reminded of your comments on the screen last night, too. I think the debate issue hones your individuality. And I would think God would be pleased to see your creating, your expressing yourself, or your knowing yourself better.
Yeah, yourself, if you're engaging in debate, you really learn what it is that you are standing for. And sometimes you change your own mind, realizing, wait, that doesn't fly like I thought it would. You get a much stronger sense of who you are and what your abilities are. in the context of debate. And debate can be, you know, done in many different ways. You know, it doesn't have to be a shouting match. And we don't see that sort of thing with God. There are a lot of ways to conduct debate. But definitely there's that engagement where the self and creativity, you brought up a really important word, a center part of debate is creativity. You're on your feet. You're using every resource that you have available to you quickly. All right.
I have a little bit of trouble with debate, God versus humankind versus humans. Mm-hmm. Because I think when I debate, I don't know the outcome. God does know the outcome. And so if God knows the outcome, maybe I'm arguing in a human way and I don't understand what mm-hmm. it's all about. Where is the creativity? Where is the where's the fun?
Yeah. Yes.
We have a quote over in the VC from Rumi about how God learns, and I would question whether God knows the outcome. God may know all of the possible outcomes, but I do believe that God changes God's mind. Yeah. In these debates.
I think that's very true.
And God and debate is where we learn. We learn, and potentially God learns.
God doesn't know your outcome. God knows he can win. He doesn't know whether or not you are going to come to the right conclusion or not.
Well, that's one way of doing it. Yeah, right here.
I want to raise the question now. Are there some cultures that are better debaters than others? And because our culture, the Lutheran culture, the Scandinavian tradition, I think there's some discomfort in debate. I don't know if others feel that way.
I think that in some regions, some cultures, some settings, some family systems, regardless of ethnicity, I think tend not to do that as much as others. What is it that holds people back from engaging in that sort of give and take? What causes that reticence?
Well, over in Norway, I've been there, and my family are part of the kingdom there, and you don't argue with the kingdom. And so that's part of the church. It's a church state. So the tradition there comes down, and you have to break it being American.
Yep.
I've heard this described as a versus sort of thing. Debate is a... Mm-hmm. And isn't it more of a dialogue? Aren't you... You know, it shouldn't be a win-lose situation. It should be a sharing.
You know, and it's kind of interesting, let's clarify here in terms of the vocabulary. I think you're right, debate in our setting today, perhaps because of our political arena, has taken on some negative baggage. We see it often as a negative thing, and perhaps would prefer to use the word dialogue, but it, essentially, they have very similar characteristics.
We've been using debate where maybe we should have said Moses negotiated with God, and I had a problem with, you know, negotiating with God, and then I thought, you know, we negotiate with God all the time. You know, get me out of this and I'll go to church every day.
You know,
but then you came back that, I mean, he's negotiating for his people rather than himself.
Right.
He's negotiating for Sodom and Gomorrah.
Let's take a look at that when you're using the word. What is... And let's say we're, you know, using American society more or less, or world society if you have another context, what is our problem with the term debate? Why does it sometimes have negative connotations? What is it about debate?
Win-lose.
Yeah. The win-lose, it looks as if somebody wins, somebody loses. And why don't we like that?
Well, then why would you debate with that? Because it would always be.
No, what if you win?
Okay, but then, of course, where does that leave you in terms of your relationship with God?
Perhaps better.
We know.
Take a look at Moses again. Moses says, God, don't destroy this people after the calf. And he goes through a number of different arguments. Because God says, Moses, go down from this mountain, they're on Sinai, and, you know, deal with your people. Moses says, They're yours, by the way. You know, it goes through a number of arguments. By the end of that discussion, debate, negotiation, God has changed God's mind. God will no longer destroy the people, and it looks as if Moses has won. The people are alive.
Yeah.
Israel will continue.
Yeah.
Is that to suggest then that God lost?
I would say that. But does God sometimes okay with that? Yep.
Why does debate have to be a win-lose situation?
I don't think it always has to be. In some situations, it depends on what's at stake. In that case, you couldn't have half Israel die. Well, I guess you could. Half Israel die, half Israel live. Abraham did that. It wasn't a win-lose situation. He was going for numbers. There are many different formats in which debate can occur. Here, yep.
And there does seem to be a compromise. None of those people get to the promised land. Right. Moses himself doesn't enter the promised land. Mm-hmm. God does come up with a promise or a compromise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm not taking you in. I'll take your descendants. You have some time to clean it up then, but you're not going.
Exactly. But the promise remains alive. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, Moses wins, or perhaps a compromise, also a bad word in today's society. Many people see compromise as a selling out, but can we look at it more positively? There is a compromise.
I think they both won.
All right.
I mean, Moses got God to leave the people and let them go, but God also wins because God then has a group of people that has been through this, and these people all of a sudden go, you know, we just got cut a lot of slack. And they do change. There is change in it. The people do recognize that God is not necessarily a totally vengeful God. You screw up, that's it, you're done.
So that there's that transformation in there. You had a comment?
Yeah, back to your question about why are we afraid to debate, or why don't we do it in Lutheranism? You can see how uncomfortable people are even discussing it here. I think it's basically a trust issue. Is will you still love me enough if I disagree with you? Will God zap me to hell if I get angry with God, or debate God? Or will my spouse still love me? Will my parents still love me if I disagree and argue or debate?
I think that's like a perfect segue into that term, here I am. What is one thing that we noticed about every time that it's used on the part of individuals? There's always a relationship. You cannot respond without relationship. And does that any relationship? That means there's got to be some trust there. These characters, in working with God, apparently trust each other an awful lot. Abraham trusts God. God trusts Abraham. Moses eventually trusts God. And sometimes it's a growing. Samuel is learning to trust God. He doesn't, who? He's kind of like, but he eventually is able to come to do that trust. But I think you're right. Will you still love me when all is said and done? That's an awful lot of faith in one another. And if God needs humans, as humans need God, does God need that? Will you still love me when we're done with this engagement? God doesn't want to stop being loved. The rabbinic text, the biblical text say that God is pained in who God is when relationship is severed. It cuts to the heart of God, if you will. That's kind of an interesting thing. So maybe is there risk then for both parties? What does that mean then when we pray? If both parties have something to risk and both parties have to bring some trust to the table. Kind of an interesting thing. Let's take a look again at these passages from Isaiah to see how God works it out in yet another one. We're going to take a look at Isaiah 58. In terms of context, the prophet Isaiah, the book of Isaiah, is divided up into three different texts, if you will. First Isaiah, second Isaiah, and third Isaiah, suggesting that there are three different authors that have compiled this text. This third part of Isaiah, the section that we're looking at today, was written in and slightly after the Babylonian exile, when the people of Israel had really hit bottom. It looked as if it were truly their end. They were in despair. Kind of like, we've been on this road together for a long time. Is this it? Where are you, God? All right. So this is sort of the context. Take a look at Isaiah 58:1. Shout out, do not hold back. Lift up your voice like a trumpet. Announce to my people their rebellion, to the house of Jacob their sins. Yet day after day they seek me and delight to know my ways, as if they were a nation that practiced righteousness and did not forsake the ordinance of their God. They ask of me righteous judgments. They delight to draw near to God. Why do we fast, but you do not see? Why humble ourselves, but you do not notice? Look, you serve your own interest on your fast day and oppress all your workers. Look, you fast only to quarrel and to fight and to strike with a wicked fist. Such fasting as you do today will not make your voice heard on high. Is such the fast that I choose, a day to humble oneself? Is it to bow down the head like a bulrush and to lie in sackcloth and ashes? Will you call this a fast, a day acceptable to the Lord? Is not this the fast that I choose, to loose the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover them and not to hide yourself from your own kin. Then your light shall break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up quickly. Your vindicator shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry for help, and he will say, "Here I am." If you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger, the speaking of evil. Here is a people who apparently is calling out and fasting and doing all these sorts of things. All right. What is it that God, and through the voice of Isaiah, sees as the problem with these calls of the people? What's wrong with it?
They're just acting out. Being faithful to God, other than just going through some emotions.
Are they just going through emotions? Is that the only thing that we have going on here? Or can we add to that?
They're expecting something for going through the motions.
They're expecting something for going through the motions, so there's two parts. What else?
They're being unfair and oppressing the poor and acting unjustly and unfairly towards.
So when we're taking a look at, we've noticed a trend in each of these situations. When you call out to God or when God calls out to people, the other is always involved. With this community of Israel, are they concerned about the other in their call to God? So whether it's just going through the motions, or perhaps they're really sincere when they do the motions. Perhaps they really mean it. But if it's for their own sake, then God says, look around you. He said, don't pray so fervently to me and sacrifice all that you have, but you notice that the workers around you are being oppressed and people are starving. It's kind of an interesting thing that call and response here very clearly takes on that aspect of the other. If you are not calling out for the people in your midst or people around you, then God says, look. Remember, we talked about vision and seeing last night. Look around you. Look beyond yourself. Kind of an interesting sort of take on that. Any other comments on the use of here I am in this passage? Yeah?
I was struck with this. It sounds almost like Jesus in the parable of the sheep and the goats. Mm-hmm. And what you're supposed to do when he's asked, what are we supposed to do for, you know?
Yeah, Matthew 25.
Yeah, exactly. And the gospel writer certainly would have had this in mind. There are a lot of quotes, particularly from these prophetic texts in the New Testament. So yeah, this whole idea of looking around yourself is very much there. Do you see other resonances or other things that jump out at you from this passage? It's kind of an interesting text. This Hineni has kind of an interesting take on this when they're taking a look at it. That whole idea of looking and vision, as I noted, comes into play. And God saying, you know, when you're calling out, be self-aware who you are and be aware of the setting in which you are in. All right? Kind of an interesting take on that. And it said, and then when you call out, I will say, here I am. All right. How does this compare with that first passage that we read, where God says, here I am, to a nation that did not call on my name? What do we make of these two uses of here I am, these passages that are fairly close to each other? Do they seem to send the same message? Do you notice any differences?
The first one seems to be unconditional. God, it's as though God is saying, even though you're paying no attention, I am calling for you. In the second passage, it does seem more contingent on the people getting their act together. You know, focus on social justice, then you can call my name and I'll be stopped.
But they are paying some attention.
Yeah, it seems like they're paying in the second one.
Right.
Yeah, it's the first one, it seems like there's no call at all, one way or another. And in that way, it does seem unconditional. In the second passage, what did you notice?
You're kind of getting it right now. You're moving into the groove, but you're not there yet.
You're not there yet. You're calling out, but, you know, your calls aren't quite in the right direction yet. So in some ways, it's kind of interesting. It looks as if the people who are completely unaware seem a little better off with that unconditional presence of God. Does that mean that God is not present if humanity is screwing up?
Well, you said he was there in the first place.
Yeah. Because God is there, you know, that presence, I guess that response then might take a different form. Yep.
I don't know if they were screwing up or if they were just doing what they'd been taught, to fast and like we go through our liturgy and stuff, but God was teaching them a new way that, you know, I don't want you to just do your fasting, your praying, your ritual. I want you to go out and take care of the poor. So I don't know if they were, it was a new learning or...
Or an expanding of that, you know, these people, yeah, that's the thing. Were they doing authentically what they thought they should be doing? Were they, yeah?
I think my feeling too, very similar. The first part, you sense there is no relationship. The second verse, the relationship is just beginning. And it's like we're at the baby steps of getting closer. You're getting closer, but you're not quite there yet. And it's about.
You're saying the ABCs, but yeah.
In the biblical text, the second is first and the first exactly. Is second. Does that, are we looking at them in this order?
We're just, you know, we're taking a look at Here I Am, but you're right. This Isaiah 65, very interestingly enough, comes right before the conclusion of the book of Isaiah. This is the concluding note.
Yeah, it's just there's just amazing grace in that. That first, God says, "Now do these things, then call my name, and I will answer. Here I am." Mm-hmm. And at the end, it's like, "You still haven't done it, but no, here I am." Leaves it at that. Despite what you failed to do, I am here, ready, available.
Exactly. And it's kind of like, we looked at those just to kind of switch those around to see what kind of difference it would make to play with those a little bit differently. But if Isaiah, the whole book, first, second, and third, all ends with, on that concluding note, even after God has said all of this, it makes us look at it a slightly different way. It's kind of remarkable. That God says, and does that look like a God who has changed God's mind, or a God who's being a little bit more willing to adapt? Like, well, you know.
Yep. We'll see if he's talking about, I mean, to relate it back to what you talked about, reading the Torah three times and not having the Torah in you. Well, then if it says, you serve your own interest on the fast day and oppress all your workers. And so that's that putting the Torah into you and acting it out. I mean, you've got to be it. Otherwise, it's to no avail.
And he's saying to do that. And I think what Shana's pointing that, even though, and perhaps this right. Is that Lutheran note in some of us, we want to end on grace. We want the good news there. You know, that sense that at the conclusion of that, you are encouraged to do this. I want that Torah and Talmud, or, you know, these things to transform you. But aside from all that, I am here. Here I am.
It also seems to bring up the question of works versus grace. Mm-hmm. Well, that's brought up the Methodist Church, so they got worse. but that whole issue, you know, do works, you know, follow directly from grace, or is it the other way around? I mean, the whole point is that, you know, works are part of this. Mm-hmm. Where, but you can't just, you know, as you say, sit in the pew and go home. If going to church Sunday morning is all we do, and the rest of the week we do our own thing, what's the point?
Well, God,
what I sort of hear with this is like, yeah, you guys, you do the things you're supposed to do on the Sabbath, but the rest of the week, where is the Torah in you?
Well, in some ways, it kind of ends on that concluding note that's a little bit more ambivalent. Regardless of what you all do, here I am. That's kind of like that concluding note of this. So in some ways, it seems as if that grace weighs it down, you know, is a little bit heavier. The rabbis have a saying about that. They say that God has to be at least 51% mercy, 49% justice. They said mercy always has to outdo justice. Otherwise, humanity could not survive. So regardless, and they're, I think they're hoping for more than 51% mercy, but they say on the scales, all you need is 51% mercy, 49% justice.
What does that say about us?
It says we need a lot of compassion. Did somebody else have a comment that I missed? Yes.
First I was thinking this was a contrast between the monastic life and, say, Mother Teresa. Mm-hmm. But the people are oppressing their workers, so they're not monastic.
No.
But then I thought of the sign that used to be over the door going out of our church. It said, Servants Entrance. Mm-hmm. Would it go out and serve after we worship?
Where some signs say you are entering the mission field.
As you go out the door. And I think that's exactly what they're saying. And it's part of kind of a very integrationist view. That sense that Torah and, you know, study of Torah and action cannot be these two poles that are far apart. The point is to bring them closer and closer and closer together until they're integrated. So you don't have that sort of, now we do one thing, now we do another. But that Torah and that study and that action have to come together.
Well, from the Christian viewpoint, all these steps are to get the people to accept Jesus' birth eventually, to recognize him.
What do you mean, all these steps?
Well, all these little lessons between human and God, or mm-hmm. God's evaluation of him, it's to a point where it's, okay, I'm gonna come through in Jesus' form. Mm-hmm. That's from the Christian view.
Yeah, in terms of taking a look at how do all these things, you know, what do they say and how do they inform our understanding of Jesus?
People.
Right. And in the sense, is there a sense of evolution in the biblical text in terms of people getting better or being ready to accept? And I think that is a debate. I think Luther would have some things to say about that. That sense isn't that we get closer to God. God comes to us. You know, that sense. So there's not necessarily that we get better as people. But God keeps reminding and we keep plugging along, you know. Other comments on these passages? Uh-huh.
Well, going back to the top passage, which is the last of the book, or I mean, close to the end of the book, it's in the past tense, though. I mean, it's to me, when I read it, it's as though God is saying, there was a time when I was willing to say, here I am, no matter what. Mm-hmm. But it's all in the past tense, sort of suggesting that maybe God is fed up and now he's going to go back to making it more conditional.
Yeah, it's like, what do we do with the tenses in that setting? I was that, I have done this. And in some ways, yeah, that is a possibility. Is it looking back into time, saying I was present at a particular time and place, but now no longer am?
That's what I'm wondering, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, you see sometimes places where God tends to get fed up with people. But God always seems to come back. We also noticed in the book of Samuel, the word of the Lord was not widespread in that time. So we don't always see, does that mean that God is not present or that God is not always making God's presence known? What are you seeing there, Shauna, when you, are you checking out?
Just searching,
okay. Yeah, yep.
But later on in 65, he says in verse 17, I am about to create a new thing. So there's this, all that's going on, but now I'm
yeah, what is this new thing? I'm about to create a new thing.
And even later in 65, verse 24, before they call, I will answer. While they are yet speaking, I will hear.
While they are yet speaking, I will hear. And it's and that kind of, you know, you do see that trend going out through there. And so in Isaiah, we see this kind of going back and forth. Is it past tense? You know, and you kind of see this going back and forth, but I think right after this passage, I am about to create a new thing. So you have kind of that past and present sort of merged right there. This is what I've done in the past. Now,
I'm going to try, is it something new? Is it different than this? Since they didn't hear me calling, saying, here I am, here I am, maybe I need to do something else to get their attention, or to show that I am present to them. Right? And there is definitely that sense in the prophets, that sense of a new thing. And what is that new thing? You know, and that God has the possibility to be creative and to try new things. Just because God has tried one thing in the past doesn't mean that God is stuck with it in some ways. Other comments? Let's take a look at 52. This is, again, they're kind of going in reverse order in terms of how we're taking a look at these. 52:1, awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion, put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city, for the uncircumcised, the unclean, shall enter you no more. Shake yourself from the dust, rise up, O captive Jerusalem, loose the bonds from your neck, O captive daughter Zion, for thus says the Lord, you were sold for nothing, and you shall be redeemed without money. For thus says the Lord God, long ago my people went down into Egypt to reside there as aliens. The Assyrian, too, has oppressed them without cause. Now, therefore, what am I doing here, says the Lord, seeing that my people are taken away without cause? Their rulers howl, says the Lord, and continually all day long my name is despised. Therefore, my people shall know my name. Therefore, in that day, they shall know that it is I who speak. Here am I. Kind of an interesting, see that kind of up and down quality of Isaiah in terms of there's a railing against the nations who have oppressed the Israelites. There's also, a definite targeting of the Israelites saying, look, here I am, shape up. And you kind of see that going up and down throughout the text of Isaiah. Kind of an interesting sort of thing because here, and this brings in some of the other events that we've looked at. We've looked at Moses. Who had to bring those Israelites out of Egypt. And that was the beginning of that Moses story. God says, I have noticed, I've seen the misery of my people. Right? And we're going to do something about it. But how long did it take God to see the misery of his people? Yeah, a couple hundred years. Some texts say 400. 400 years of slavery. So you might have wondered if people in there weren't calling out before, and where was God in all of that? Interesting setting. Let's take a look at some of the questions.
Is there anything different between here am I and here I am?
Pretty much the same, you know, translation. Take a look at question number 2. How do Abraham, Jacob, Moses, and Samuel's use of Hineni inform our understanding of God's use of the same phrase? So, you know, we kind of did this progression this week, and we've kind of been building up our sense of the phrase, here I am, or Hineni. Do we look at these Isaiah passages differently, having looked at these other characters first? Do they inform our understanding of God's saying, here I am? We understand them any differently because we've read about Samuel or Abraham.
I want to comment on that a bit. It was interesting for me, and I hadn't thought about it, the here I am or the Hineni phrase to me now means something to the effect that use me, Lord. You know, mm-hmm. I'm here to be used. And now in the Isaiah passage, it's as if God says, people, you know, use me. I am the way I'm to be used. You know, it's and
kind of like, here, I'm ready. I'm willing. I'm prepared.
Yeah,
call on me.
Mm-hmm. So it's a reverse, but, you know, instead of the individual saying, I'm here for you, now it's God saying, I am here for you.
Yeah, it's kind of a powerful thing. Yep.
And it seems to me in just about all of those, the here I am came before the person knew what was going to be asked.
Yep.
And I, you know, so God is saying, before I even know what you're going to ask me, I'm telling you I'm here. Regardless of what you are about to ask me or what you mean in the future, I am here.
Yeah, that's really interesting when we talk about trust and relationship for God to do that. You know, it's one thing for people to do, you know, say, you know, here I am, but for God to say, before, you know, you even make your needs and your requests known, I'm here for you. That's a lot of trust. That's a lot of relationship.
It reminds me of someone saying to me, will you do me a favor? And you're going, yeah, like what day, what time, how much is this going to involve?
So the phrase is, you sometimes try to do the well. Not a yes, not a no, but you kind of want to, you know, feel it out a little bit. Exactly. But here you have these individuals as well as God not saying, it depends.
But going beyond this to the Testament, Jesus doesn't say God says, well, he says, ask.
Mm-hmm. Ask.
God will provide all of your needs. Ask, which shall be given to you. Don't be afraid of, you know, look at the parable of the father, you know, and all the things he talks about how we expect fathers to act. Mm-hmm. And God is even more so. So I find this much more open in a sense that everything you have and you are comes from me. Ask.
Ask. Yeah. Yeah.
In a more contemporary frame, how many times must the Jews have asked during the Holocaust, where are you, God?
Mm-hmm. And they have, you know, a whole new frame of reference and theology has emerged from the Holocaust for both Jews and Christians in terms of asking that question, where was God during the Holocaust? What happened to faith because of the Holocaust? How do we view our systems differently? How did the Holocaust change how we see God? And I think it's entirely true for an entire couple generations of Jews that it fundamentally changed their understanding of God. Many Jews became very totally secular if they emerged from this whole thing. If you're here on Monday night, there was the movie, and the two little boys were asking, their Israeli boys were asking their grandfather, do you believe in God? You remember that? He was not willing to answer exactly. But do you believe in God, they kept asking. And he said he believed, I believe in fate. And he said, and there's room for God in there. But that was a person who lived through the Holocaust who'd seen a lot. And I think, yeah, it did fundamentally change his understanding.
Uh-huh. Let's look at the Holocaust, you know, from a point 4,000 or 5,000 years in the future and put it into the, how is that going to relate to the Babylonian story and the Egyptian story and all that. And I think that those people, I mean, if we were looking, I'm not sure exactly where I'm going, but I don't think it's that much different than what has existed 5,000 years that's always happened to the Jewish people.
Always, in some ways, it's even more so considering it was almost an extinction of a race and you didn't, and there isn't, you know, so it's in some ways intensifying what we see in the biblical text. But, yeah, it's definitely an element to try to figure out what to do with. Yeah, here I am. Where was God? You know, so, and that's a very tough question. I don't know that there's an answer to that. I think people are trying to, you know, figure that out.
What about African Christians that are starving and it's asking you, it will be given you, mm-hmm. and they're starving?
You know, and part of the thing when in this whole response thing, when it's always in relationship with the other, how does God provide? How does God provide for the needs of people throughout the biblical text?
I think, and I may have misled people, so was my thought. God provides us with what we need. So in the case of my family and my life, when my mother went through 12 years of cancer, where was God? My mother died when I was 13. Where was God? It's a very personal thing. Where was God in that act? Mm-hmm. Where God was is God was with my mother all that time, and God put up with me having a roiling two-year argument with him as to how he could exist to be so horrible. Mm-hmm. But God is what got me through that. And I didn't get what I wanted. I got what I needed.
In some ways, and I think that's a part of, and I don't know if that's the same or different as your question in terms of people who are starving and they say, God, I need food. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the same question or not. Do they have what they need? That's a tough question. When we look at these texts, how does God provide for those needs throughout the biblical text?
Through other people.
through people.
He says you feed them.
Exactly. So there are the resources out there to feed these people. So whose fault is that? Well, it's tricky, you know, you kind of look at that, you know, we don't want to make these things so simplistic, but if we look at the biblical text and God provides through the other, and there are resources, and you said that there is everything that we need, but some people aren't getting what they need. Well, that here I am response perhaps has been coming in maybe not enough lately.
I think that for me, that's what was different in this today versus yesterday before. This call is very specific to social justice. Mm-hmm. And we are the hands of God.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, you really clearly see that in Isaiah in terms of this idea of justice for the other. In each of these cases, it's a more limited circle in some ways. But actually, when you take a look at the story of Jacob in terms of ensuring the future of a nation, it wasn't so much social justice, but it was, you know, looking at the promise. But you're right, very clear direction on social justice today. And it's interesting that the focus in these passages is on God and social justice. God finally gets a chance to define that here I am in these passages. Kind of interesting when you take a look at that. In terms of, take a look at number 6, at the final question, and we've talked about it a little bit differently. Do we call God differently, or do we call upon God differently than God calls on us? Is it the same sort of thing? I'm curious. Do we call God in the same way that God calls on us? Ideas.
We usually call God out of a place of despair, whereas God calls us as a place to come. I'll give you a comfort.
So, and I think that's a good word choice in terms of usually. Yeah, there is that sense. We call God out of despair. God calls us out of a place of, you know, yeah, I'm here for that despair.
Uh-huh. I have some idea. We call, tend to call because of our needs, rather than saying, God, I'm here. Where would you have me go? What would you have me do?
Any similarities in these calls? Can they ever be more similar than different?
Well, you started out by saying, does God need us?
Right.
So maybe there's that too.
Yeah, is there ever a point where God is in despair?
Considering the nation of Israel, I'm sure there were lots of points.
Well, we have to picture the testament of Jesus weeping over Israel. Certainly, how about the United States? Despair over the losses of Israel.
Yeah, we never think of that. I think our and I think most of the time it is that us calling to God out of our despair. But what about when God calls to us from God's despair? That's a big responsibility. I'm like, don't call today, God. I've got enough of my own. I wonder what to do. What, you know, how do we respond to a God who calls to us in despair, or when that God's, so to speak, heart is breaking? What might our response be to that? Can we comfort God?
He wants to hear, here I am.
Yeah, that's the relationship. It goes back to the beginning. Oh, yes, there is relationship. I think that's a perfect way to end our study. Thank you very much.